This edition of Midori House was first broadcast on the 16th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Steve Bloomfield. On today's programme, the United States launches its first airstrike on the outskirts of Baghdad since the formation of President Obama's coalition. We'll assess whether the West really should be taking on Islamic State militants at all. I'll be joined by Daniela Peled and Oscar Guardiola Rivera, who'll discuss that and more of the day's key news stories from around the world. And a little later, there's just one full day of campaigning left in Scotland's historic independence referendum. The opinion polls continue to suggest that the race is too close to call.
We've got much more in common, not only as English, Scots, Irish and Welsh, but as humanity. So I'm very much for kind of finding common ground. So I think we should stay together.
We'll also check in with one of our correspondents from around the world and take a peek behind the scenes at a major new exhibition on China's Ming Dynasty.
They had Vietnamese experts who advised on arms. They imported Japanese swords. They had Middle Eastern astronomers at court, Korean cooks. It really was truly international.
All that, plus we'll review the week's latest music releases. That's Midori House with me, Steve Bloomfield, starting right now. But before all of that, here's Bill Bingham with all the latest news from around the world.
Monocle 24 News. The United States has carried out its first airstrike against Islamic State militants in Iraq under a new scheme to degrade and destroy the extremist group. US officials say the attack destroyed an IS fighting position southwest of the capital, Baghdad, 5 days after President Obama outlined his new anti-IS strategy. Islamic State, sometimes known as ISIL, has seized large areas of Iraq and Syria and declared them a caliphate. The chairman of the US Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Martin Dempsey, told a Senate panel they plan to extend the airstrikes.
While this work in Iraq is taking place, we will simultaneously pressure ISIL in Syria. With coalition partners and contributions, we will begin building a force of vetted, trained, moderate Syrians to take on ISIL in Syria. This won't look like a shock and awe campaign because that's simply not how ISIL is organized, but it will be a persistent and sustainable campaign.
Ukrainian MPs have granted self-rule to parts of two eastern regions and an amnesty for pro-Russian rebels there. The law affecting Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which is in line with the ceasefire introduced 2 weeks ago, was condemned by some MPs as capitulation. Meanwhile, Russia says it needs to boost troops in Crimea, annexed by Moscow in March. The rebels in the east have been battling Ukrainian troops since their seizure of a number of towns in April. The United Nations, Israel and the Palestinian Authority have reached a deal to allow reconstruction work to begin in the Gaza Strip. Officials for the United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, or UNSCO, say the deal will give a leading role to the Palestinian Authority. 50 days of conflict in Gaza between Hamas militants and Israel, which ended late last month, has left swathes of the Mediterranean enclave in ruins. UNSCO Middle East Envoy Robert Seri says they're implementing security safeguards.
My office, UNSCO, has brokered a trilateral agreement between Israel, the Palestinian Authority and the United Nations to enable work at the scale required in this trip, involving the private sector in Gaza and giving a lead role to the Palestinian Authority in the reconstruction effort, while providing security assurances through UN monitoring that these materials will not be diverted from their entirely civilian purpose.
The International Organization for Migration says around 500 migrants are feared dead after their boat was rammed off Malta last week. The IOM says two Palestinian survivors are claiming the boat was deliberately rammed by traffickers. The organization says more than 2,500 people are now believed to have drowned in the Mediterranean this year. In the latest incident, more than 200 people are feared dead after a boat carrying 250 sank off Libya. As the countdown to Thursday's independence vote continues, the three main UK political parties have announced plans to devolve more powers to Scotland. The pledge, signed by David Cameron for the Conservatives, Ed Miliband for Labour and Nick Clegg for the Liberals, also promises sharing of resources and preserving public spending arrangements. The Yes campaign have described it as an insult to voters. Better Together call it a vision around which Scotland can unite. Travellers from all over Europe are facing continued disruption as Air France pilots stage their second day of strike in a dispute over cost cuts. The airline cancelled 6 out of 10 flights on Monday and predicted the same level of groundings for Tuesday. Pilots intend to strike until the end of the week. Austrian Airlines cancelled 15 flights on Wednesday due to a meeting of staff called by its Works Council to inform them about the status of a labour dispute after workers won a court victory last week. That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. 1806 here in London, at 706 in New York City. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto
to Amsterdam,
all around the world, this is Monocle 24.
It's Midori House. I'm Steve Bloomfield. Welcome to the programme. My guests today are Daniela Pellad and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Daniela Pellad is an editor at the Institute of War and Peace Reporting. Oscar Guardiola Rivera is a senior lecturer in law at Birkbeck College, London. Welcome to you both. We begin with Iraq. As we just heard from Bill, on the outskirts of Baghdad a little earlier today, the US launched airstrikes against Islamic State militants, the first since President Obama's coalition began to take shape earlier this week. It is very much a US-led operation, with so far little of the load being taken on by countries in the region. Daniela Pellad, should the West actually be taking the lead here? How important is it for them that they have some sort of cover from other countries in the region?
Well, I can't see any how it could be any other way than the West taking the lead. But I do think cover, as you put it, is very important from other countries in the region. There is a very interesting coalition emerging with varying levels of commitment in terms of actual military involvement. I think what's interesting as well is the involvement. What's slightly outside the discussion is the involvement with the West will have with Syria and with Iran on this issue. I think they're skirting around it using very, very precise language, or very, very obtuse language, to be more precise. but it's inevitable. They will have to, if not coordinate, then avoid actually clashing with the Syrian state and with Iran.
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, the US working with Iran, possibly working with a sort of a nod and a wink with Syria. Is this in some ways a good thing? It shows that when, you know, we all have a common enemy, we can all come together. Or is this just, are there other words to describe this?
Well, if anything, it shows how wrong we were before. We knew that what we were trying to do in Syria would have the worst consequences, and the worst consequence has been IS. And in that respect, yes, of course, everything that can be done to rid the region of such people is welcome. Having said that, as was pointed out before by Daniela, the legal case for going into Syria is still complicated.
Why does legality matter in this?
It does matter. It mattered before. It mattered the previous time we went into Iraq.
Let's say on Iraq, for example, you know, had the UN Security Council passed that infamous second resolution, if Russia and China had merely abstained and they got a majority on the Security Council, that technically would have been legal. And yet, I'm fairly sure you'd still be sat here saying it was a terrible mistake.
Not necessarily. Coalition would have been different. The decision-making process would have been different. The caution and experience of other allies, such as Russia, would have been very useful. One has to hope that Iran's presence this time might make a difference. We should also expect a different attitude towards those who we know are funding IS, people who move freely in places such as Qatar, Kuwait, and even Saudi Arabia.
Daniela Peled, the Russians a year or so ago were saying about Syria, look, you know, yes, you know, Assad is a dictator, but he's a secularist and he's our ally and we have no problem with that. You people in the West need to think hard about who your allies are. They're Saudi Arabia, they're Qatar, they are people that perhaps have their own agenda, which actually deep down you don't agree with.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm rubbing their hands in glee now. And as I said, the West is trying very hard not to fall into that trap of saying, OK, we're siding back with Assad now. But this became a significant movement when ISIS moved outside Syria. And the situations in Syria and in Iraq are very different. In Iraq, an international coalition will operate with the blessing, the welcome, the desperation of the Iraqi government. And I don't think very much fuss would have been made had they not... had ISIS not torn up Sykes-Picot and spread across the border and become such an international movement. I think the largest number of its recruits, according to a piece in The Economist, is from Jordan. Now, if you have more than 1,000 Jordanians coming back, which are going and training, coming back, and that's an immense... I think the danger in the region is much more than the danger that has been very beloved of the newspapers here, thinking about Western jihadists or 70 Swedish jihadists. I think that's the real issue. If it had been contained in Syria, I think the Syrian crisis would have been allowed to just go on and on and on, because what ISIS were doing in Raqqa until some months ago were trying to set up their own very misguided and very unpleasant, but... their own Islamic State, and doing things like collecting rubbish and trying to adjudicate legal issues.
Oscar, if this had stayed in Syria, you said before that, you know, that the West had got it wrong in Syria, but surely... But there are two ways of looking at this. Some would say the West has got it wrong because although they had warm words for the opposition, they never actually backed that up with any real financial backing, certainly not military backing. But are you arguing that actually they got it wrong by merely intervening in the first place or taking a side?
Oh, absolutely. They were wrong in taking the side they took. The side against Assad was the wrong side.
Why was that the wrong side? This man's a dictator who killed thousands of people, who used chemical weapons.
And you just think there may be no question about that, but we now know that had the West contained the situation there by not necessarily providing... weapons indiscriminately to groups which we were told were from the very outset going to engage in this kind of warfare, we wouldn't have had the problems we have today.
Sorry, on that point, bring in Daniela Peled.
Yeah, no. There's no. I really don't believe that we're talking about providing weapons indiscriminately. I think if anything, we didn't. The reason there isn't a situation is the West did not intervene decisively enough.
Well, that's absolutely not true. We know that Qatar was intervening there. We knew that Saudi Arabia was
intervening there. We knew that they were doing the US and the UK and France.
But they were doing so because the West allowed it to happen. And we knew from the very outset, you just said it yourself, Daniela, when the Russians told us, look, this guy is really awful. But look at the people you're siding with.
But the opposition,
and that was the problem.
The opposition was far from united, which was one of the problems in the first place. And the Syrian revolution started as a secular democratic grassroots effort, which many other groups capitalized on. The secular opposition has been very disunited. But Qatar and Saudi Arabia are not the reason why ISIS are rampaging through the Middle East. Now, ISIS don't need this outside support. ISIS are perfectly self-financing, thank you very much. And I still think we're perhaps putting a sticking plaster over a wound, but I think even an injection of money, I think it could do an awful lot of good. I mean, look, ISIS are paying, what, upwards of $400 a month to fighters? I mean, that's a very simple equation. For young men with no qualifications who can nip over there.
Daniel, on that issue of the... sort of the personnel, if you like, that ISIS has. How many of them are fully signed up believers, essentially, in the ISIS philosophy, if we can use that phrase, and how many do you feel are actually, they are people that have joined this fight to get rid of Assad, and now that we're in a situation where there's a brutal civil war, will take whoever can pay them and whoever can, you know, give them a weapon and a uniform?
I think it's different, once again, in Syria and in Iraq. In Iraq, they have the support of Sunni tribes who, as we all know, have been disenfranchised over the last decade or more. And so they've managed to co-opt other people. But I don't believe, and from talking to colleagues in Baghdad, the impression I get is that these Sunni tribes and these in the regions do not support the ISIS vision of a state. They don't support this kind of extreme theocracy. And certainly in Syria, I think it's a very broad coalition. You have an awful lot of young men who've gone because they can do wheelies in tanks and build a new state and build a new reality, and it's all very glamorous and exciting.
I want to just leave it there because I want to move on to the slightly more uplifting story of presidential elections in Brazil. The latest opinion polls suggest that the race is tightening in favour of the Socialist Party candidate Marina Silva. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, a month ago it looked like Dilma Rousseff would be re-elected relatively comfortably. Obviously there's been a lot of events inside Brazil since then, including the tragic death of Eduardo Campos. What do you think is going to happen now? What's your take on where this goes?
What is at stake in the Brazilian election is whether or not Brazil will continue to be the ally of the rest of Latin America, and perhaps its leader vis-a-vis the world, or else he will go back to be a satellite of the United States. Now, on the surface, it does look as if Marina Silva is representing what she calls a new politics. But what we are hearing from inside Brazil is plenty of voices, for instance, the well-known theologian Leonardo Boff, warning that actually Marina Silva is being backed by the Brazilian right, who has never before wanted either a worker or much less so a black person in the presidency. But now they're backing her. Part of the reason may have to do with the fact that she is making certain promises about the economy and Brazil's foreign policy that sound much more palatable to the United States, because Brazil has been very, very crucial to the BRICS-led project of building a bipolar world. And this is the reason why many of the social movements which were discontent with the compromises made by the Workers' Party are now going back and rallying behind current President Dilma Rousseff in order to save what they see as the conquest of 12 years of the PT government.
Daniela Pellet, we've had, as Oscar says, 12 years of the PT government, the Workers' Party government in Brazil. And in that time, Brazil has become something of an international player. Whether that's through the BRICS, which still no one can really explain to me what these four or five countries have in common, but, you know, still.
What they are building. Nothing before, but that's precisely the point.
Well, there are arguments about what's being built in either India or Russia, and let's not even get onto where China's going in terms of democracy. But certainly when we look at Brazil's role in world affairs, Daniela, they've played more of a role certainly in the last decade or so than they had before. How important do you think, Israel has, famously sort of slighted somewhat Brazil's efforts on the world stage. Do you think, that this election could be quite crucial in terms of how seriously others continue to take them?
Well, the encouraging thing about this election, and I think we're going to talk about the Scottish referendum in a while.
I'm afraid we have to.
Looking at it from this point of view, from Britain, where generally politics are very milk and water, and the characters are pretty dull and dry. I mean, this is an exciting story. This is a woman who has an extraordinary background, who comes from a minority. I mean, just the fact she's a woman, also that she's running against a woman, which is fairly unusual. And I think there's a great drama in this story. And, Yeah, you know, there needs to be, Brazil needs to continue to keep its place on the world stage and continue to push itself as a beacon, as a diplomatic power. I don't know whether she would be happy to see her future platform as based on environmentalism. I don't think that anybody can lead a country with that as their central focus.
Oscar, there was a great photo that was shown during, in fact, the World Cup of the three presidents of Chile, Argentina and Brazil, three women. And it was shown next to the three presidents of Chile, Argentina and Brazil 35 years ago. And it was three military men in full uniform. It shows just what a massive change has gone on in a generation across the continent, doesn't it?
It does, and I cannot stop emphasizing how important that story is for the future of the world, not just the Americas. Here we have an example, a very optimistic example, but also an actual example of a continent that 35 to 40 years ago was in a very different, very murky place. And now we have something very different, and the very symbol of that are these three women, but also women like Marina Silva. Having said that, it is very important to take stock of the fact that there are many in the continent who would like to see things in reverse, who would like to see that past of 40 years ago coming back. And many of those are rallying as we speak behind Marina. So she has to be very careful in her decisions to make sure that her position remains the one that gives resilience hope.
Oscar Guardiola Rivera, Daniel Pérez, thank you both. Just for now, you're listening to Midori House. We'll be back after this.
Global affairs, culture, business, design or urbanism. At Monocle 24, we've got it covered. And when it comes to transport and travel, you need look no further. From automobile innovators to the creative minds shaping the in-flight experience, we speak to the experts to ensure you have all the industry news you'll ever need. In New York, our transport editor, Tristan McAllister.
Whether it's a closer look at the global aviation heavyweights or embedding with the people who keep Alaska State Ferry System afloat, we take you to the people and the places that make our world move.
Take to the skies, the rails, the seas or the roads with Monocle 24, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. Daniela Peled and Oscar Guardiola Rivera are still with us. Time now to discuss the Scottish referendum campaign. Just one full day of campaigning left. Polling suggests that the No camp, which are campaigning, of course, for Scotland to remain within the UK, are still very slightly in the lead. But frankly, none of us really know. Now, I'm guessing that I have a no voter and a yes vote. Well, I mean, neither of you actually have a vote. Neither of you have a vote at all.
Exactly.
Shameful as it is that a Colombian academic living in London doesn't have a vote on Scotland's future, or indeed you, Daniela. But Daniela, why... why would you vote no were you to have a vote in this election? I'm assuming you're a no.
I'm a no if you gave me a vote and told me that I absolutely had to use it. But I acknowledge I'm very much an outsider in all this. As a citizen of London, I like to see myself, I'm not a big fan of nationalism. And I do see it coming down to an emotional need, which is also... an important one. I think the idea of the union has an emotional resonance, and the idea of independence has an emotional resonance. I mean, that's what it's down to. It's not really about any financial or economic argument. People want, and the Scots I've spoken to who support a yes vote say, it's time, we need and we want and we should have our own country. It's as simple as that.
Their own country, but not their own currency, not their own head of state, not their own broadcasting corporation.
We have no idea what will happen the day after a yes vote. It's only conjecture.
We can only speculate, and that's quite fun. Oscar Guardiola Rivera, again, I'm making an assumption that you would vote yes.
Let me say that Colombia should have a vote, since actually we are the ones to blame for Scotland going bankrupt in the early 18th century after the crash of the Dariana scheme and having signed the Treaty of Union. So we should have a vote. My vote.
So it's all down to you. Excellent.
Absolutely. My vote would have to do with the fact that, indeed, as Daniela says, this is not about arcane issues concerning monetary arrangements, but it does have to do with something that is not just emotional, or rather, as David Hume would say, this is an emotion that marks our very reasoning. And the motion has to do with a democratic call, a democratic to govern oneself. You cannot go and tell the Scots that this is the triumph of atavistic emotions of ethnicity and nationalism. That would be, at the very least, paradoxical, since the Enlightenment happened there.
But actually, Oscar, you say it's about emotion and connection and nationality. But actually, to many Scots, they also see themselves as Britons as well. There's that emotional connection to Britain. So it's not just about, this isn't, an independent nation that's trying to sort of throw off the yoke of colonialism.
No, it isn't. It is, among other things, emotions which matter to reason. For instance, I have before me a front page of the previous devolution of a paper during the previous devolution in 1979. The headline is, "No vote will not kill devolution, pledges Margaret Thatcher." That says something about what is going on in Scotland. There is a reaction to the kinds of economic values and the vision for politics and economics that is dominant, more dominant south of the border, the one that we inherited from the Thatcherite
I'm sorry,
reaction.
I must say, there is
and
this...
But come on,
this issue about Scotland somehow being more left-wing than the rest of the country, that doesn't necessarily stack up. There are a lot of very, very conservative Scots, particularly socially conservative.
I wouldn't say necessarily more left-wing, but it is a fact, and actually this is not a new fact. It goes back to 200 years ago. Scotland 200 years ago had a higher male literacy rate than England, and universities in Scotland 200 years ago would cost a tenth of what they... of what Cambridge and Oxford would charge back then.
Well, not many people went to university 200 years ago.
There is the issue, as Daniel points out, that not many people go to university now.
And the fact that more people go, we owe to the Scots, among many other things. So my vote is for a Scottish Enlightenment. And whether yes or no, what really matters is that this has opened up real political discussion in Britain and in the rest of Europe, because Spain is watching. That's important.
That's definitely true, isn't it, Daniela Pella, that there has been, particularly within the last few weeks, this gradual understanding that there is now a proper debate, because the UK doesn't have a constitution. I remember learning at school about our unwritten constitution, trying to get my head around the concept of something that was a constitution, but it wasn't ever written down, and we all sort of just knew it, but we muddled along. And now there has been real discussion, hasn't there, over the past few weeks, about the fact that our politics doesn't work very well. I think even no campaigners would agree with that. And that there needs to be some sort of change.
Well, there is going to be change. I mean, that's quite clear. There has been the paradigm has shifted. But I think you're absolutely right. And I think one of the issues here is how we define ourselves. And the day after a yes vote for Scotland, I think, will be a day of national trauma for England. I mean, the English, I think this is one of our strong points. We've always struggled a bit to define ourselves. What is England? What makes us English? Is it fish and chips? Is it chicken tikka masala? Is it Scotland? Is it? And I think that goes to our benefit. Now, take Scotland out of that issue. I think that's going to really leave an aching gap in the British psyche to fill. I don't think that's a positive thing at all. I hate the cliche of saying that we're better together, but unfortunately, in this case, I have to agree.
But what this is revealing is the poor state of British politics, as you both have put it. It is the case that the whole of the British establishment suddenly descends upon Scotland and seems to defend issues and interests that seem to belong more to the financiers than to the people who are ready to vote. So here we have an imbalance of politics. And we should take this opportunity as one to have a proper political discussion on what we want to be.
I want just very quickly, Oscar, because you mentioned before about people watching in Europe. Obviously, Catalonia is having its own unofficial referendum in November. If they vote yes, Spain obviously isn't going to recognise it, but it's going to be cause of huge national debate. There's then the Basque issue, which has been very quiet recently, very quiet, but there are all sorts of questions there. How do you see that unfolding?
I had the opportunity. I spent the last 2 months in Spain and Scotland, and in Scotland, actually had the opportunity to talk to a Basque senator. And for them, this is a totally a political issue. The issue of Catalonia and the referendum vote aims at breaking the back of bipartisanship in Spain. And something similar that echoes, at least to a certain extent, with what is happening here. This sort of compromise between two parties, one a little more conservative, another one a little less so, but the two standing for the status quo and the need for proper transformation.
Whatever happens on Thursday, I'm sure it will affect others in Europe. Daniela Pérez and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us on Midori House.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Tu vai Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo. London, New York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half hour here on Midori House, we'll be in Los Angeles. We'll review the week's latest music releases and bring you a taste of a new exhibition on the Ming Dynasty, which opens on Thursday.
They had Vietnamese experts who advised on arms. They imported Japanese swords. They had Middle Eastern astronomers at court, Korean cooks. It really was truly international.
But first, here's Bill Bingham with the headlines.
And the main stories. United States has carried out its first airstrike against Islamic State militants in Iraq under a new scheme to degrade and destroy the extremist group. U.S. officials say the attack destroyed an IS fighting position southwest of the capital, Baghdad, 5 days after President Obama outlined his new anti-IS strategy. Ukrainian MPs have granted self-rule to parts of two eastern regions and an amnesty for pro-Russian rebels there. The law affecting Donetsk and Luhansk regions, which is in line with the ceasefire introduced just over 2 weeks ago, was condemned by some MPs as capitulation. The United Nations, Israel and the Palestinian Authority have reached a deal to allow reconstruction work to begin in the Gaza Strip. Officials for the United Nations Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, or UNSCO, say the deal will give a leading role to the Palestinian Authority. Travellers from all over Europe are facing continued disruption as Air France pilots stage their second day of a week-long strike in a dispute over cost cuts. And Austrian Airlines are cancelling 15 flights on Wednesday due to a meeting of staff called by its works council to inform them about the status of a labour dispute. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Bill Bingham, thank you very much indeed. 18:33 here in London, at 10:33 in Los Angeles, and that is where we're heading right now, where our correspondent Sasha Eisenberg is standing by. Sasha, welcome to the programme. Let's begin by looking at the what used to be thorny issue of Obamacare. It was going to be a big part of the election debate. Obviously, the midterms coming up in November. Republicans were hoping quietly that it was all going to fail, so they could say what a terrible mistake it had been. Are they going to be able to do that?
No, I mean, there's been sort of gradually all these incremental bits of data sort of measuring the success of of the Affordable Care Act and its sort of different provisions as they've been enacted. And they all tend to point to the law doing what it was supposed to do, which is covering people who didn't have insurance and sort of unexpectedly bringing down costs sort of across the healthcare system, in some cases more quickly than had been anticipated. So the most recent data point, which just got released today, is from a large-scale survey that's fairly well-respected that asks individuals about their health insurance coverage. And just under 4 million people have gone from being uninsured to insured in the time that the that Obamacare has taken effect. And as you suggest, we sort of see in concert with all this new data pointing to the success of the bill, fewer and fewer people pointing to the sort of, you know, election polling about opposition to it.
Does this mean that Democrats are likely to be campaigning on Obamacare and saying, hey, look, we brought this in. It's been a huge success. Vote for us.
Yeah, this is where you sort of see how tentative Democrats are. I mean, what's definitely happened is Republicans who wanted to run on this issue and point to their opponents who had voted for it or suggested that they would be opposed to repealing it are quiet entirely. You see no advertising or speeches on that side. Democrats, it's a little more touchy, especially in some of these states like Arkansas, Louisiana, Alaska, where Obama is very unpopular. I mean, Obama did this, what seemed at the time like clever move to embrace the term Obamacare in 2012 when he thought it would work for him to sort of motivate his base. It, basically, the way that the White House talked about it is our opponents are calling it Obamacare. We're getting all the downside from this. Why don't we sort of reclaim the upside? Well, the problem now is, in many places, Obamacare is more popular than Obama is personally. And so Democrats like Allison Lundergan Grimes, who's running in Kentucky, are actually okay with the bill, but don't want to have his name attached to it. And that's sort of the language problem that Democrats are.
Have they gone back to calling it the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, and you see this in advertisements where they want to talk about the Affordable Care Act, but it just doesn't have the same salience. We see in polling people, you know, there's been polls that show like 20-30% more people say that they support the Affordable Care Act and support Obamacare, and they're asked about it, and it's the exact same thing. And basically everything we understand is that people transfer their opinions about Obama onto the bill, and at the moment he's unpopular, and that doesn't seem to be shifting. He's not getting credit for it, even if people are recognizing in their lives and the lives of people around them that the bill is actually having its intended effect.
From healthcare to casinos and the slow death of Atlantic City, or certainly its gambling industry, tell us more.
Yeah, you know, Atlantic City, along with Las Vegas, basically invented the modern casino business in the United States. A totally down and out resort city, like one of the great sort of 19th century resort cities that fell on hard luck on the New Jersey shore, made this big bet on casinos in the 70s. And other than the occasional mafia infiltration, was sort of great in many ways for the local economy. Now, so many places around the country have, both at the city and state level, have adopted casinos as a way to generate more revenue, that there's just too much competition for Atlantic City to be a destination anymore. And so, you know, Philadelphia and New York, which are two cities within a couple hours of Atlantic City, have both made moves towards having their own casinos. We've now seen in the last couple weeks alone two casinos, one the Trump Plaza, named for Donald Trump, who developed it a couple decades ago, go out of business. And previously, the Revel Casino, which had opened just 2 years earlier. And so this is bizarrely the sort of failure, the death of casino gambling in Atlantic City is directly attributable to the sort of success it had over decades, encouraging other cities to follow its lead.
And finally, Sasha, I just want to talk about NFL, American football, or football as you guys just call it, and the enormous problems that it's now having surrounding its handling of domestic violence cases after the suspension of Ray Rice, who, of course, you know, many of us have now seen the video of him punching his now wife. And this has become a bigger issue for the NFL than just simply one case, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a sort of horrible coincidence. Just a couple days ago, Adrian Peterson, who plays for the Minnesota Vikings, a major star, was charged with beating his four-year-old son in incredibly violent ways. The court records are incredibly graphic. And the Vikings initially took him out of the team for last weekend's game and then said that they're going to put him in pending the legal process, which just sort of now is making this more about more than Ray Rice and generally about a league that people say doesn't have a sort of consistent policy, and when it does is not sufficiently aggressive in dealing with domestic violence, you know, both of women and now of children. And I think that there's starting to become some pressure on sponsors and advertisers to sort of take a, you know, bigger stand against the league's handling of all this.
How much pressure has actually come from fans? Because, you know, sports fans, you know, let's face it, can be slightly myopic when it comes to these issues. They care about what happens on the field and really nothing else.
Yeah, and I think that, you know, you get sort of casual fans, not necessarily of the team, but of the league. And it is the biggest sport in the United States, gets the biggest TV ratings, who claim that they're sort of generally discouraged with the league. But there were plenty of sites of fans showing up at Ravens games in Ray Rice jerseys, showing up with Adrian Peterson shirts on recently. And there's, you know, some suggestion when it comes to the particular teams, as you suggest, you know, they're not willing to give up the ability to win, and these are both stars, and so it becomes very difficult to, I think, take a political or moral stand the way you might if it were a sort of marginal player on your squad. These guys are pretty essential to each team, and it just makes it a lot more difficult for either the team or the league to cut them out entirely.
Monocle correspondent Sasha Eisenberg in Los Angeles. Thank you very much indeed. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Up next, we'll preview a new exhibition that showcases some of the gems from China's Ming Dynasty. Stay with us.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
That's brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Welcome back to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Steve Bloomfield. From this Thursday, the British Museum here in London is hosting a new exhibition focused on China's Golden Age. It's almost 600 years after that age ended. Ming, 50 years that changed China, will look at an age when China was a dynastic superpower. It was during this period which Beijing was established as the capital and when the Forbidden City was built. Many of the pieces showcased in the exhibition are being shown for the first time outside China. Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco went to get a preview. Here's his chat with the curator, Jessica Harrison-Hall.
First of all, Jessica, I just want to see which specific era is the exhibition about?
We've taken a section of the Ming Dynasty from about 1400 to 1450. The Ming Dynasty itself lasts for 276 years, but we're looking at a pivotal moment in which Beijing becomes a capital city and in which the Ming Empire is founded.
And how relevant was this specific 50 years for China and the world, may I say?
It's terrifically important because at this point, multiple courts are established across China, and these courts are internationally engaged. It's the moment when the Forbidden City is built in the heart of Beijing, the landmark which is still used on coins, on military uniforms, and as an emblem of China. But it's also the moment where flotillas of ships were sent from Nanjing all the way to the east coast of Africa, commissioned by the Yongle and Xuanda emperors. And these flotillas of boats carried 27,000 men, many of whom were armed.
And one of the things that surprised me in the exhibition is how this period felt so international for China in a way, because they did a lot of trade with other countries. And it's quite interesting as well, even to compare it to today in a way, because I think China is kind of rising again as this global superpower.
Absolutely. I mean, we're all familiar with blue and white porcelain, which is perhaps the world's first global product, in that it was exported throughout the world and then copied wherever it landed. But this exhibition is more than about export porcelain. It's about what China absorbed from those outside contacts. So, for example, the folding fan, which we think of as being quintessentially Chinese, is in fact brought in from Korea and Japan. They had Vietnamese experts who advised on arms. They imported Japanese swords. They had Middle Eastern astronomers at court, Korean cooks. It really was truly international.
And I just want to find out what can we see here at the exhibition, because I know a lot of pieces, they're being shown outside China for the first time, correct?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this exhibition glows with the range of different materials. As we look around us, we can see solid gold vessels, beautiful jewellery inlaid with gems, stunning silk costumes and silk hangings. But we can also see bronze sculpture, guns, swords, helmets, and a wealth of hanging scrolls and hand scrolls which depict everything from hunting scenes to one of the most beautiful paintings of plum blossom by moonlight. And then right at the end, we have a Western oil painting, a Renaissance work by Mantegna, which dates to the end of the 15th century and shows the adoration of the Magi, with Christ being presented with a small early 15th century blue and white cup. So it really is an extraordinary range of different types of material.
How long did it take for you to compile all those objects and do the research?
Well, we've built the exhibition into five sections: courts, the arts of war, the arts of peace, belief, trade and diplomacy. And bringing these 280 objects together from 30 different institutions, from museums, libraries and private collections, has taken us about 5 years. We began working on the idea in 2009, and it's taken us now till 2014 to complete it.
And finally, I just want to ask as well, because sometimes some of the paintings, they feel very modern as well. I love the painting where they're playing some sort of football in a way. Can you tell us a bit more?
That's a wonderful painting. It's 7 meters of very brightly coloured painted images from inside the Forbidden City gardens. And it shows the emperor in a series of different sporting scenes with his palace eunuchs. In one scene, they're playing a kind of keepy-uppy, which strengthens the thigh muscles, and the emperor's sitting on a throne with balls in nets either side of him, and one of the eunuchs is kicking the ball up and down in front of him while another holds a spare ball. And further down the scroll, we can see a kind of golf. We can also see polo, archery, and one of my favourite scenes is the emperor throwing arrows into a vase with a meal of 14 different dishes behind him and one pair of chopsticks.
How do the Chinese view this era nowadays? I mean, do you have any idea? Do you think they look at that period like with grace and everything?
Absolutely. This is a golden age. It's not to say that it's the only golden age in Chinese history, which has a history of 10,000 years, but it is an age in which there was relative peace and stability, economic success, and also this extraordinary international engagement through these multiple courts.
That was Jessica Harrison Hall, curator of the new exhibition Ming, 50 Years That Changed China, which is on at the British Museum from this Thursday. She was speaking to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Midori House, 1848 in London, 1348 in New York. In a moment, we'll have a listen, indeed, to some of the best new releases from the week with Pete Norton. To take us there, this is one of them. It's Leonard Cohen and Almost Like the Blues. To keep away the rot. Leonard Cohen there, Almost Like the Blues. Pete Norton joins us now to take us through the best of the week's releases, including that. Pete, welcome to Midori House.
Thank you very much.
Nice Leonard Cohen, 79, almost 80, yeah. 80 later this month.
He's 80 on Sunday, I think.
Happy birthday, Leonard Cohen.
Yeah.
He's still got it, hasn't he?
He very much does, yeah, and it's really nice to hear a man in such sort of senior years still, still working away and really producing stuff of great quality, I think, you know. That track isn't particularly fashionable in any way. You know, the production is quite sort of straightforward blues progression, but I think he's really got it vocally and lyrically.
And it's, you think that, you know, this will still be popular because it's great or because it's Leonard Cohen?
Well, I think because it's great. I mean, I don't know if everyone would agree with that. You have to be, you know, that people do diverge on him. But I really am a fan, and I think there's a lot in that song that's sort of, it's very current, but not in a pushingly sort of trendy way, you know. It's just it's a great piece of lyrical songwriting,
and it's also noticeably Leonard Cohen. I mean, yeah, you can't not recognise that voice.
No, and he's kind of gone deeper as he's grown older, and he's got this almost like a kind of civilised Tom Waits or something. He's got this lovely gravelly thing, and they record his voice very close to the mic, so it feels very intimate. But I also think Leonard Cohen is one of these artists where he's his body of work is really great thing for other musicians for cover versions, because there's a lot to it, you know. Musically, they're quite sparse often, but there's so much lyrically there. You know, Hallelujah is the obvious example of that, which has been interpreted by numerous different people.
Yes, some very good, some less so.
Yeah, yeah.
Indeed. Three other tracks that you wanted to talk about. Let's start, hopefully we can cram them all in. Let's start with Thievery by Arca. Before we hear what you've got to say, let's hear a little bit of it. Thievery by Arca. Tell us about them.
So it's one guy. He's a Venezuelan-born, now New York-based DJ and producer. He's worked recently with Kanye West. He worked with Kanye West among a huge cast list of other producers, but on the Yeezus album. And he's also helped to produce FKA Twigs' LP1, which has just got nominated for the Mercury. So he's kind of, his star is rising. But it couldn't be more different from Leonard Cohen. This is the kind of coalface of experimental, weird electro music. But I really think he's a kind of name to watch, a bit like Jamie XX was or James Murphy 5-10 years ago. I think Arca, you'll hear more about him. And I think there's something very, very current about what he's doing, you know.
And are we also, do you think, likely to hear him collaborating with lots of different artists in the same way that, you know, half the things on the radio for a certain period of time last year seemed to be a Jamie XX remix?
I really think so, yeah. I'd love to hear what Arca would do with that Leonard Cohen song, just to put it out there, if you're listening. I really think there's something really thrilling about his sound, because it's unusual. There's a lot of space to it, and there's this kind of these recycled glitchy beats and samples, but it doesn't feel derivative. It feels original, you know.
Let's go from Arca, Venezuelan born, to North Wales, Llandudno, yeah, no less. Catfish and the Bottle Men. This is Pacifier. I feel like I'm listening to the Evening Session again.
Yeah, well, Steve Lamacca is a big fan of this.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he is, yeah.
that surprises me in no way whatsoever.
Well, there you go.
I mean, what makes it new? What makes it, is this just, you like this because, you know, in the same way that I do, because it reminds me of the late 90s, or is there actually something new and different about it?
That's a good question. I think the criticism of Catfish and the Bottlemen, if you want to criticise them, is that they are quite a straight-up indie band. But I've seen them live a couple of times now, and they really have this great thing. It's joyous, and it's direct, and it's for all the right reasons. It doesn't feel hipsterish or cynical. And they deliver these fantastic pop songs. You know, they're really fully fledged, very catchy, lots of energy. I think actually they're better live than on the record.
I was going to say, yeah, they sound like, from the way you're describing them, also just from hearing them there, that they'd be actually, you know, a really great gig.
It's one of the best gigs I've been to in the last year.
Oh, really?
I saw them at an XFM showcase thing last year and was really taken, and then they got snapped up by Island Records and saw them this summer at Latitude as well. And they're just great. They'll go places, I'm sure.
And they've got a great name.
Yeah. The story of the name, very briefly.
Okay, go on then.
The lead singer, whose name is Van McCann as well, which I don't think you can go wrong with that. He lived in Australia, and he met a busker called Catfish the Bottle Man, who perhaps you can imagine what such a busker might look like.
There we are, indeed. Yeah. Just finally, I want to fit in this. It's Every Other Freckle, which is new from Alt-J.
Yeah, so Alt-J, new album out next week. Obviously, it's hotly anticipated. They won a load of awards last time, Ivor Novello and Mercury. And it finds them in really great shape, I think.
Let's hear a little bit of it. Now, I like that. The problem I have with it, and we were talking about, you mentioned Jamie XX before, that XX's second album sounded pretty much, you could tell it was the XX.
Yeah.
And this, immediately, from everything about it, particularly his voice, is undeniably Alt-J. Do you think it sounds a little bit too similar? They haven't really progressed in any way?
Do they
need to progress?
Well, it's one of these sort of difficult second album kind of questions. Do you go far out there and release a Kid A kind of thing just to prove that you're still a great band, or do you go with it? And I think actually they've balanced it quite well. If you listen across, there are a range of different genres in this thing, and it feels they're working confidently, but it doesn't. It feels like creatively they've had their own agency, you know.
And also, Radiohead waited until album 6 or 7 before they inflicted Kid A on us.
Yep.
I wasn't a fan of that.
Were you not?
I kind of think I might be a fan if I started again now.
Yeah.
Listening to it again now, but at the time, no.
I struggle with Amnesiac for sure. I can take.
Okay, we'll leave it there. Pete Norton, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Indeed. All those songs are pretty much out now. You can find them, I'm sure. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. My thanks in particular to our special guests, Daniela Peled and Oscar Guardiola Rivera. Midori House was produced by Thomas Lewis and Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Erin Duffy. The studio manager was Joel Church. Up next, for the headlines, it's Section D with Monocle's design editor Tom Morris. Do stay tuned for that. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours in London, 1300 hours in New York. My name's Steve Bloomfield. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
London. Tell Beijing.
This is Monocle 24.
Nach Amsterdam.
A Bogota.
To Hong Kong.
All around the world.
This is Monocle 24.
Rolex is responsible for several landmark innovations in watchmaking, including the Oyster, the first waterproof wristwatch, and the perpetual rotor self-winding mechanism. Crafted from the finest raw materials and assembled with scrupulous attention to detail, Oyster Perpetual watches benefit from Rolex's cutting-edge technology and extensive expertise. Epitomizing the values that have made the brand world-famous, Oyster Perpetual watches symbolize a way of life, a benchmark for style.